Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, our love is like our music. It's here and then it's gone. We raise our glass to the good and the evil, and we dig into a mentholated sandwich.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man well.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Please allow me to introduce myself. See what I did there, guys?
Yeah,
I am Tony Slagle, and I am your host for today's episode of This Is Vinyl Tap. We are broadcasting from our southwest annex of the Vinegaroon Saloon in the live music capital of the world, Austin, Texas. As always, I'm joined by our normal host and fearless leader, Doug Cooper.
I don't want to talk about me. That's been enough about me. What I would like you to do is get your phone out and send an email to tappingvinyl at gmail.com. And tell us where you live and tell us your favorite album. Do that right now. We'll have a short pause. Thank you.
All right. And of course, we're joined as always by our humble, although I have it typed in my notes, humble producer, Jonathan Chamro.
Good morning, Tapsters, or good afternoon, Tapsters, I guess.
We're going to be talking about a Rolling Stone album. In fact, we're talking about their 1968 album, Beggar's Banquet. This is the band's seventh British album and their ninth U.S. album.
Yeah.
So we'll get into a little bit of why that's odd.
Yeah.
It was released in December of 68, and it is considered, after a brief misstep from their previous album, a return to their blues roots, if you will. Yeah, this is not your pick, is it, Doug?
It is not.
And again, the reason why I made that comment about longtime listeners is most of you who've listened for a while realize it's in no way my pick. So we're going to go to JM, whose pick this is. And JM, I'd like you, because this is a band you like a lot.
Yeah.
This is a band that's been around for, I think, 400 years.
This is the Paleolithic. Is this the biggest rock and roll band that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, because we've done Zeppelin, we've done the Beatles, we've done the Who. Who else would go into that
Pink
category?
Floyd, I think.
Pink Floyd would go into that category. I don't know if
Queen is
maybe
big.
Fleetwood Mac. I don't know.
The Kinks, would the Kinks fit into that one?
Not that big.
I don't think they're that big.
But Fleetwood Mac's big.
Yeah. But not the album we talked about.
That Fleetwood Mac stayed relatively within the...
This is definitely... And to be fair, before we go to UJM, I don't want to make this all about me, but I think that was a little bit in deference to my musical tastes. I've many times talked about my...
Disdain.
I want everybody to understand that I know that this particular episode of this podcast would be no good if I just sat there and hated on this band the entire time. So I'm not going to do that because that's dumb. I'd like to have a good...
what ELO is for.
And I'd like to assure everybody that this is not going to be that. I want to have a good conversation about this album and this band, and I can be critical without being hateful, I hope. You guys can call me on that if I get too weird about it. So Jam, again, yes. A band that's been around for 400 years. Why this particular album? Why is this an album you want our listeners to have us talk about? This particular album, Beggar's Banquet.
Okay. This album and the three subsequent albums after this, I can listen to every single song. And I officially like every single song that they have done during this period. And one of those albums is a double album. It's also this period of is when a lot of people think that they did hit their stride, where this is like the classic Rolling Stones sound from Beggar's Banquet to Exile on Main Street. The reason why I chose this album, even though it's not my favorite of those four albums, I think I came into this Rolling Stones sound with Exile on Main Street. And I think it's best to go to the beginning, because this is the first song where, I mean, the first album where the sound really, the Rolling Stones sound really started coming into its own. I think we're going to talk a little bit about that because it has to do with two things. I think one, Brian Jones kind of losing his
marbles
in the band. Yeah, losing his marbles and basically, you know, just losing interest in being a Rolling Stone. And the other one, I think, is their producer, Jimmy Miller, I think really brought a interesting element to their sound. Like I said, it's not my favorite one.
Which one would be of that period?
Exile on Main Street. I just think that's a flawless album. One of the other things I just find really interesting about this album, too, is that it seems like we're being a little bit brought into their world. Because the songs really started to me seeming like they were talking about what was going on in their lives or what they were thinking.
If I can briefly comment on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some of the subject matter of these songs, I'm not sure I want to necessarily be brought into their world.
I
know. World.
And I have the same reaction. I don't want to be in their mindset, especially I don't want to be in the mindset of Keith Richards. I mean, just where these songs were coming from, it just doesn't sound like it, you know, it sounds like debauchery, and it doesn't sound like it's they're having the, even though it sounds like they're having fun, it doesn't sound like they're grounded in anything.
I think the other thing that's important, if I may interject myself, which sure. I'm the host, I guess I can do that, about this particular album that we're talking about, how you're talking about it being the start of a phase, and you mentioned Brian Jones. This is transitional to a certain extent. This is the last album he had anything really to do with.
Yeah.
He's instrumental in the early part of their career.
Yeah.
This is it. But is it Mick Taylor who takes over for him as
Mick
a guitarist?
Taylor, yeah. And so he doesn't make an appearance until...
After the album after this,
yeah,
right? Because the album after this is...
Is it Sticky Fingers?
No.
Or Let It Bleed.
It's Let It Bleed.
Yeah.
And Brian Jones helped on that a little bit, but not a whole lot. This is the last album he really had any sort of real, like, you could hear him, his sound
yeah,
on
and
stuff.
I do want to get into Brian Jones and his, you know... drug use and mental state at this point. But yeah, he was very instrumental in their sound, and he was losing, not only was he just kind of losing interest in the Rolling Stones, but and he was not showing up in the studio. And
right.
And but when he did show up, they said he was just showing up with different instruments.
Yeah, he'd show up with a sitar.
Yeah.
This is what I read that what Jimmy Miller said. He'd show up with a sitar that was completely inappropriate for the song they were recording the day. Yeah. And so Jimmy Miller would, I mean, this sounds really sad. He put him in a part of the studio, have him play on it, but they would not put it in the mix. They were really babying him a lot and treating him. Part of it seems a bit enabling. Part of it, I get. We talked about this with Pink Floyd. When you're dealing with somebody like a Syd Barrett, who's just not—he's not contributing anything—and you're young. These guys were young still when this came out. It's easy for us being in our 50s to look back and say,
"Yeah,
they handled this incorrectly." But
well, you know what? You know the filmmaker Godard.
Yeah,
yeah.
He said that he helped him tie up his little band for shooting up heroin in the bathroom for him. So I think that counts as enabling when you do the little surgical band.
Yeah. But before we go into that deep dive we're going to do to talk about Brian Jones and his issues, I did want to just go back to the transitional thing, because I read, just agreeing with you in terms of what most people think, that Mick Taylor phase of the Stones, because he leaves and they bring in Ronnie Wood.
Yeah.
Is what people see as that is like their golden era, those albums, and I think you can count this as part of, even though Mick Taylor's on it, this is where they kind of rediscover or re-emphasize their what they were doing before.
Does their songwriting get better?
I think the songwriting gets better. I think that the musicianship gets better. But I think,
what are the hits before this, the biggest hits before this album?
Ruby Tuesday, Under My Thumb, Satisfaction.
So is it about five albums?
I don't know.
Where they had their good run?
I think that where they started kind of losing it was
Goat Head Soup.
Started losing me was Goat Head Soup. Or it just sounds like things are just starting to get a little more slick. Yeah, Let It Bleed.
Sticky Fingers,
Exile on Main Street.
And then they went for a while, and then it seems to me that they didn't until Some Girls.
But that's not that far off,
no,
is it?
No, that's like 6 years. But
this is a band that seems to have had several, quote-unquote, comebacks.
They count this as a comeback, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though I think it's a little silly to say that, because the album before this, Their Majesty's Satanic, what is it? Their Majesty's
Her Majesty's Request.
It's not Their Majesty.
Yeah, it is.
It's Her Majesty. Oh,
okay.
So. You have to learn this royal stuff.
I think there was a competition between the Stones and the Beatles for a while. And even though the Beatles were still around when they were making this album, I think that they just started saying, we don't care. We don't want to be anything like them anymore.
Were they reactive? Trying to be the anti-Beatles in some ways before?
Well, that's goes into, we're kind of getting into the history at this point, but they really, I think they were reacting a lot to the Beatles, especially with their Satanic Majesty's Request.
What happened was their manager, Andrew Luke Oldman.
Yeah.
Who was a young guy, younger than them when he started managing them.
19 when he started managing them.
He initially had them Beatled up. Like, I think their first album, they're wearing matching suits. There's pictures of them in matching suits.
They're called, even going something like the Beatles, like, you know, Meet the Beatles, or now it's the Rolling Stones, England's Newest Hit Makers, or something like that is the name of their album.
Right. At some point, he realized he could bank on pitting them up against the Beatles, and making them the anti-Beatles. So he started this campaign where he would say in the press, would you let your daughters sleep with the Rolling Stones? Well, they changed it because you couldn't say sleep with the 60s. They changed it to
I saw an interview with him, and he kept saying, you know, the kids like this, the teenagers like this kind of music, but the adults really hate it.
Yeah.
And he kept going over that over and over again.
So I think it's worth mentioning, because I'm one of these idiots who has, for most of my life, falling into this Beatles versus Stones dichotomy, which is kind of silly if you think about it, because there's so many bands that I love and listen to that were influenced by the Rolling Stones. And you hear it on this album, in particular one song, that it's dumb for me to dislike this band the way I feel like I needed to, because I'm firmly in the Beatles camp.
Yeah.
When it's not even close. It's not like, oh, the Stones are nipping at their heels. I mean, they were a successful band and they were having hits at the same time, but the amount of sales.
No, I think if I may say so, if I may be so bold, the quality of the music as well, overall, over their span of their career. Now, the Stones kept going, but the reason I bring it up is it's not just the music, it's this mentality of you've got this kind of good boy, and it's so funny because the Beatles come from a lower middle class background. They really were sort of borderline hooligans to a certain extent. Yeah. And you got the Stones, who are all from middle to upper middle class families, college students or whatever, who weren't like this but embraced it. It's really kind of silly. It's all marketing.
Well, and there's that element, I think, that I know people who come from small towns that when they go to college and they get a job in a big city, and they start hating everything that would indicate they're rubes from the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yes. You know, we strictly listen to NPR now, all that kind of stuff. And then you have people from the city that go to the country and try to hick it up. I just wonder if some of that wasn't going on with them.
I think there are. I mean, because Ryan Jones was a really smart person. And, you know, Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics.
I think Tony's right, but I don't think it's just their management. I think they've played up the we're the bad boys,
and
I think they've done that. And I think the fact that they're still alive, I remember, what was that song? She Was Hot. Come right by.
so white to brown. She was she pinned me to the ground. She was
she knew where. Yeah, and that came out and had Keith Richards, and he's sitting there acting bad, picks up a whole bottle of Jack Daniels and walks out. But I don't believe that for a minute, especially now that I'm about the age they were when that album came out. Yeah. And well, they're not. If they're living that, I've heard like Mick Jagger is running 6 miles a day, and then as soon as the show's open, he locks all the doors and they sit down and count the money and go over the books.
That's right. We know JM loves these guys. Mm-hmm. We know I've talked about my struggles with the band a bit. I think you might be somewhere in the middle. Maybe I'm wrong, but I am interested in that.
There's the brain dug, and there's the heart dug. I look at the Rolling Stones, and I see a talented group. I see two good songwriters. I see an enormously influential band. They of the British Invasion, I think they're number two after the Beatles for influence. I think of course, the Kinks are on their tail because a lot of punk and other stuff.
Well, the Who are in that camp too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there's something about the Rolling Stones that I've never been able to get very close to. And I think part of it is ugliness. And there is an ugliness about the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're... And I'm not just talking about the appearance of the guys, but there is something, and there's something in art where, especially those who think shocking or being different is important. I look at art from the Middle Ages or the Renaissance, and I see beauty everywhere, and then something in this past, not this century, the last century, something about ugliness came in, and something about ugliness came into music. And there's something about the Rolling Stones that's ugly. It's sound. There's a sound that's kind of ugly. This album cover is a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah.
And
you mean the one that they eventually released? We'll get to
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah. But, yeah. I just like to point out to ladies and gentlemen at home, I have the other album cover. You know that line in American Pie where he's, I saw Satan laughing with the delight the day the music, and Don Henley's out there in the audience going, "You're ruining music." There's a little bit of that inside of me. Having said that, when I was a freshman in college, Tattoo You was out, and that was a big album. I went to go see the show, and I used to listen to that album all the time. But one of the things that I used to listen to that record to get ready to go out, to help me get into mood to behave in a way I knew I shouldn't be behaving in. And when I associate the Rolling Stones with me being who I'm not supposed to be, that's another part of it.
Well, there's such a visceral part of the Stones. I mean, that is so much about their persona. It does appeal to the base, the baser elements of you. And I'm sure that is 100% calculated. But I also wonder if, what you're talking about, the ugliness, the Beatles came out of the American songbook and folk music and everything, and the Stones were really in that blues element. And a lot of the blues isn't exactly, uplifting. It does talk about...
Oh, you're saying the blues can be depressing?
Yeah, and it's the subject matter. And I think that, the Stones were, if they were being...
There's a difference authentic between the Buddy Holly side of American music and the...
Which is my side.
And the Muddy Waters side of American music.
Let's touch on that a little bit, because Doug, you and I were talking about that a little bit before JM showed up today. I've come to terms with the blues in a way, due to this podcast that I never had before, because I've had to listen to some of it. And I realized that I don't dislike the blues like I used to think I did. What I dislike is this distillation of it through British artists like the Stones or Eric Clapton. And I think there's a part of that is there's a little bit of lack of genuineness to me from that. Because I think the bands, I'm not saying they're not talented or they don't like the music, but I think when you listen to the original stuff, it's hard not to feel the authenticity and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, just listen to any Robert Johnson song. And
I'm gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my brown.
I believe I'll dust my broom. Up in the black man you've been loving.
You're going to be blown away by it.
I also want to go back to a word you used, which was calculated. I also think that when the Stones are mired in this whole, when they're writing their own blues songs and they're mired in this whole dirtiness aspect of it, that's calculated in a way that the blues artists necessarily weren't. When you're a black musician in the 1930s and you're singing about sex in a sort of a double entendre, sort of under the current way, that was a fairly dangerous thing for those guys to be doing at that time.
Yeah.
This is not dangerous for the Stones to be doing this.
Right.
And it's very calculated. And again, that's not to take anything away from what they're doing. It's something I've come to terms with, that it's like, what is it about this that kind of gives me a little bit of a pause? And I think that's where I've come down on. I don't know if there's any, if that resonates with anybody else, but that's sort of where I am. With it, because I realize now I can listen to old blues artists and I really enjoy the hell out of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not anything I was open to before, but again, listening to this stuff and having to listen to historically, I'm like, I don't dislike this at all. This is good.
Yeah.
One of the things I hate about myself is my adolescence and how
we're all there.
How important it would be to poke an eye and say things that were was naughty, or
something that's designed to raise an eyebrow. Yeah.
And when you get old, you hate that. Mm-hmm. You don't hate it because it's naughty. You hate it because it's just silly and particularly unoriginal.
You see it for what it is.
And when I hear so many things in Rolling Stones songs, like unnecessary comments about African-American women who want to participate in a certain activity all night, or dead men at the end of Start Me Up, doing particular things while it's played at a ball game. It cracks me up. It's played at a ball game and everyone's clapping and they're singing something hideous.
I think
there's a lot of that. Brown Sugar's another example.
Well, there's a song on this Stupid album girl. That's that way.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, we're being dirty.
I think there's
the bathroom wall on this album is such a great.
Well, this is a pattern for them. I mean, there's several times going forward before this album ever even is a blip in their eye where they were banned or they had some. The record company's like, you can't do that, you know. And it was all about pushing buttons.
What's wrong with being sexy?
Well, you know, they've got a song on Exile on Main Street called Blank Sucker Blues. I mean, why do that? I love the song.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, and I was trying to figure out why Zeppelin doesn't bother me the way the Stones do. And this just popped in my head when you mentioned that. The Stones seem to be very surface level. Like the old blues stuff was very sort of, hey, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It wasn't on the surface. The Stones, when they're writing these songs, it's kind of out there in the open. They're not hiding really behind any sort of imagery. They do sometimes, but in general, it's like, oh, this song's about a 15-year-old groupie, and there's nothing to hide that.
Yep. Yeah.
Whereas when you're talking about Zeppelin stuff, and I know they co-opted a lot of old blues songs, but you know,
the Stones are a little bit like South Park if South Park wasn't funny.
Yeah. this is what I was talking about.
Just the ugly without the humor.
But that's what I'm going back to. It sounds like at this point we're being led into their world.
Yeah.
And they are talking about what's going on in their world.
Yeah.
Stray cat, you know, dead flowers with, you know, all of that. They're letting us in and into their world. And, you know, Keith Richards was heavily into heroin. In fact, the album before this one, he couldn't go into the studio a whole bunch of times because he was having, you know, be in court.
Yeah, but that wasn't because of heroin. That was because of other drug stuff. I think the heroin stuff with Richards happened after this.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a very long answer.
But I think it's an accurate. I mean, I think it's not something I hear when people talk about the Rolling Stones. It's not something I hear a lot.
Well, I think it's because people don't pay attention. They like the feeling of the music. They may sing along with the words. I mean, I've done that with songs.
They got
some of the most compelling power chord combos that, like the beginning of Start Me Up. No wonder everybody wants to play that at the sporting rink, because that just gets you going like nothing else. And they also, they have space in their music that allows that to come out in a strong way.
I'll tell you, as many bands as I've played in, playing the Rolling Stones is just fun.
One of the things I found interesting is another thing Doug and I talked about a little bit is I think, you know, when you talk about the guitarists in this band, and they, you know, they've had the constant of Keith Richards, but then they've had these other Brian Jones, Mick Taylor, and Ronnie Wood. People consider Keith Richards a lead guitarist, but there's not really a lead guitarist in this band. And what's fascinating about what these guys do is they interplay off each other. They play leads, they play rhythm. Keith Richards is maybe the best rhythm guitarist around in terms of what he's able to do. I'll even say that.
I think he's the best riff maker.
But I find it fascinating that this is that they've always had two guitarists because that's important to their sound, that ability and that they find necessary to play off of each other in a way that that other bands don't do. Yeah. The other thing I want to say that I found kind of struck me as odd, because again, I don't have a whole lot of history with this band. I would listen to songs that I thought were written much later than they were, because there are songs that the Stones wrote in the 60s that don't sound anything like anything else that was written at that time. They sound much later.
To me, they couldn't write blues songs. If you listen to their early stuff that they started writing, it was Andrew Lou Oldham who said, hey, why don't you guys start writing music? Because he had two reasons why he wanted to do that. One, there was more money. Or because they didn't have to get any licensing done. And the other reason was that he saw that there was a pop sensibility to him, and he thought that might give him a little bit more
air. But I mean, look at Under My Thumb. That song does not sound like it was written in 1960 whatever to me.
Yeah, 65.
It's just weird. I want to put a caveat in here. This is a band that's been around for a long time. We're going to talk a little bit about where they came from and some of the stuff before this album we're talking about, but we're not going to go into and some of you might be going, thank God. We're not going to go into the long, detailed history.
There's a lot of books and a lot of documentaries.
You can go if you're interested in that stuff, but I do think it's worth kind of scratching the surface on some of this stuff. One of the important parts of this album we've addressed a little bit is Brian Jones's kind of demise and where he was. I was not aware of this being a casual Stones. Well, I don't even call me a casual Stones fan.
A casual Stones non-fan.
Yeah. That this band was essentially early on Brian Jones's band. I mean, he was the guy who started it. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards have known each other. They went to grade school or grammar school together.
Yeah.
And they kind of lost touch when Jagger's family moved. But then I just wanted to think this is a funny story. They ran into each other on a train station when they were both in their, I think, late teens, maybe early 20s. Yeah. And Richard sees Jagger on the train station, and he's holding these chess records that Jagger had imported from the U.S. And according to what Keith Richards says, he says initially he was going to go over there and steal them from him until he realized who he was. And then they started talking. They sat on the train all the way into the city and kind of rekindled their friendship. And they ended up starting a band together with Dick Taylor. Right? Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys is what they were called. Yeah. Brian Jones gets into the picture because he's part of this blues scene in London. There was a band called Blues Incorporated, which was a pretty big deal. They had a bunch of people. I mean, Jack Bruce was part of that band. Ginger Baker was part of that band. Charlie Watts was part of that band. And the guy, Alex Corner, whose band it was, he would have these blues nights. And so people who were like-minded would come down and start playing it. And so the Richards Jagger Taylor band goes down there, and they're interested in it because they're attracted like a moth to a flame to this blues stuff.
Yeah.
And they run into Brian Jones, who's going by the name of Elmo Lewis
at the time. Lewis, yeah.
Paul Jones and Brian Jones form a band called the Roosters. And then Brian Jones ends up leaving to start his own band, which where we get the Stones going. But do you know who replaced him in the Roosters?
Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton replaced him in the Roosters. Brian Jones puts this ad in Jazz News. Jagger and Richard show up. Ian Stewart, like all these people show up. This guy, the drummer at the time, is a guy named Tony Chapman. Anyway, they start this band together. This is essentially the core of the Rolling Stones. And they don't have a name. It's funny how they get their name, which is Brian Jones is I've got heard two stories. Either they're being interviewed by a magazine or they're talking to a booking agent. Regardless, they're on the phone and somebody asks him, what's the name of your band? And he's, for a minute, they don't have one. So he looks around and he sees, a Muddy Waters record, and on that record is a song called Rollin' without the G, Stone. And so he's like, oh, we're the Rolling Stones. And so they call themselves that for a little while without the G. Obviously, eventually they adopt the G. Yeah. By 62, Bill Wyman joins. He replaces Dick Taylor on bass. And then Charlie Watts joins by 63. So
Brian Jones was a phenomenal musician.
Yeah.
And he was a multi-instrumentalist. And he didn't sort of play these instruments. Like, he started off as a saxophone player.
He played the flute, too.
And he played the flute.
What's fascinating to me about Brian Jones is he is like a true blues guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he loves the blues. But later on in the Stones' career, when they start expanding their sound, much to the detriment of people who are purists, Brian Jones is the guy who's bringing all these weird instruments in.
Yeah,
he's bringing the sitar in and the mellotron and all this stuff.
He started losing interest in electric guitar. He started wanting to really kind of play slide acoustic.
I think the one detrimental thing he had going against him once they start writing their own music is I don't think he had the capability of writing songs.
Yeah.
At least not songs that anyone thought had any sort of potential.
Right. And that's when
Does he have any credits at all?
I don't think he has any credits on any.
Yeah, so JM, you were mentioning Andrew Lou Goldman, who becomes their manager. We talked briefly about him, but he is instrumental in, once he gets the band going and he becomes their manager, he's instrumental in kind of pushing them away from Brian Jones. What's funny is when they signed their contract, Brian Jones got five pounds more than anyone else in the band because he was considered the leader of the band.
Saw the potential of Mick Jagger being the front man. So,
well, let's talk about him briefly because he was all about image and commercial potential because what he does is essentially say to Ian Stewart,
He says,
you're not going to be part of this band for two reasons. I don't know if he said this to him, but he said, there's not any popular bands that have more than five members. Yeah, the public doesn't want to know more than five members.
They can't count to six.
Yeah. But the other thing was he thought he was ugly.
Yeah. And he was older.
He was older and ugly. And he's like, you are not going to be. So he said, this is your option. You can either leave, or you could be the road manager and we'll sit you off to the side. You can play on albums and stuff like that, but you're not going to be. That's why Ian Stewart, who was a full-fledged member of the band before they signed, is now listed as an additional musician on all their stuff because he's not a quote-unquote member of the Stones at this point.
Yeah.
Jagger and Richards don't ever seem to have really gone to bat. And this isn't maybe fair for me to say, but it doesn't seem like they really went to bat for any of these decisions as they start coming up. It's like, no, we're okay with that. We're okay with that. We're okay with that.
And I think they started getting into their own little cocoon as well, because that they did start writing songs together. What I read about Richards was he would be sitting around playing guitar, and Jagger, who I've also heard is kind of a very polite person, wouldn't react if he heard something that he didn't like Richards playing. But if he did hear something that Richard liked, he would start getting very enthusiastic and start trying to sing along with it and actually say, hey, I think I can write lyrics to that.
Jagger wrote music too, I think.
No, he did. He wrote
the melodies.
We're dealing with a situation where the credits don't help you understand how the song came together. So
one
of them brought a song complete by itself, it would still say...
Well, that's what happened with the very first song on this album. I mean, from what I understand, for Sympathy with the Devil, or Sympathy for the Devil,
that completed project by Jagger.
Jagger had it. What Richards did was figure out what the tempo and the rhythm should be.
Well, and he made a huge contribution. He organized the hoo-hoos.
Oh. Yeah, and he did all the bass and the guitar.
You know, I think there's about 80 people that claim to be in the chorus.
Going, well, you can see it online. We'll get to that. But so, as we mentioned, Oldman was responsible for getting them to write their own music. The reason why is he brings the Beatles into the studio. Mm-hmm. The Beatles give the Stones, "I Want to Be Your Man," before they record it. So, yeah, that was the Beatles gave that to the Stones. It was their first top 20.
Yes, the first one went to number 12. Was that the one?
Yeah, it went to number 12 in the UK. Yeah. I mean, that the whole reason Oldman brought the Beatles into the studio was to try to inspire them to write some songs. So they actually write their very first single, which is As Tears Go By.
It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play. Smiling faces I can see.
It's a pleasant enough little song.
I love that song.
His voice doesn't sound like that very often.
No, it doesn't. But he can do it when he wants to, when he's not...
When he doesn't get
swaggery jaggery.
He gets his prolapsed esophagus in most of these songs. Oh. You can tell he's not from Texas when he sings this.
They end up releasing their first LP in 1964, which is titled The Rolling Stones. It's number one in the UK, 12 weeks, reached number 24 in the US. Starting with this album going all the way to Between Buttons, just like the Beatles, there's different versions. There's a UK version and there's a US version, which makes it difficult for guys like us who are trying to be as close to being right as possible when we do these things.
It's like they didn't even consider podcasting.
They did not.
So short-sighted.
This album only contains one song written by them, by Jagger and Richards, Tell Me You're Coming Back. The U.S. version has a version of them doing Not Fade Away by Buddy Holly. So Aftermath is the first album that's all...
Every song is a Jagger Richards.
But this is also where Brian Jones starts bringing in other things. Like, he plays guitar and harmonica. I think there's a sitar on that. There's an Appalachian dulcimer, whatever that is. A Japanese koto.
Yeah.
Marimbas. He's doing all of that stuff on this album. I mean, he is their secret weapon when it comes to padding their sound out.
Yeah. Usually if you're hearing an instrument that is not typically associated with the Rolling Stones, it's because Brian Jones is playing it.
What are the hits on Aftermath?
Paint It Black is on the US version of it.
That's right.
This is going to sound, when we talk about the album we're talking about tonight, like a broken record. The album is delayed because this original packaging and title was Could You Walk on Water? And the label is like, do we really want to release that in the States? That could offend a few people. We've already been down that road with the Bigger Than Jesus stuff. So,
or it could be exact opposite reaction and they could end up next to Genesis in the religious section.
Exactly. So the Stones end up settling on the title Aftermath. An interesting little side note about that album, it's the UK version is 52 minutes long. It's the longest runtime for a pop album up until that point.
Is that right?
Yep. Huh. That's interesting.
And when we talk about Paint It Black, what they did is on the UK version, that wasn't on it, but the US version, it was a single. So they took, this is what they did back then. They took that single, put it on the album, and removed four songs off of the UK version. And what labels would do in the US is they would pull these songs off and then they'd cobble them together and do a US only release. That's why the US albums are ahead of number wise of the UK albums. The Beatles are the same thing. They released all these compilation things where they pull tracks off of albums or redo them or whatever. Mm-hmm. The other song you wanted to talk about or was worth talking about on this album is what, Jam?
It's Under My Thumb, which I think is a pretty interesting song. You don't really hear a lot of songs like that, especially
in 1966.
66 with marimba. That is such an integral, that marimba is such an integral part to that song. I just can't imagine.
It works great. Yeah.
Well, and also, this is a
great song.
It's a prime example of something that no other rock band in 1966 was making a song that sounded like that. That sounds, as a casual listener, I always thought that song was much later in their career. It sounds like something from the 70s to me. Yeah. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
That in 66, that was a song that was a hit of theirs.
Yeah.
So part of the demise, Brian Jones's demise, is not only was he sort of living the lifestyle that they were all purporting to live in a way that the rest of them weren't. I don't want to get into too much of this, but he has six kids by six different women.
Yeah. Going back to when he was like 17 or something.
Yeah.
And he was not exactly, he was not an attentive parent.
Let's put it that way. I think most of them were put up for adoption too.
Yeah.
Well, I saw a full grown kid talking about meeting his dad for the first time.
Yeah.
Well, makes me sad.
Yeah. I think most of them didn't know they were Brian Jones's kid until much later. Something happens in 1967 that impacts the band tremendously. Two incidents, actually. One is Keith Richards and Mick Jagger get arrested.
Yeah.
There's a raid on a party at Keith Richards' house.
They're arrested for doobies?
Well, I think they found other things there. They found marijuana. I think they found some methamphetamines as well as some other stuff. They use, I guess, the Dangerous Drug Act of 1965 is what they use. A trial's held, and Jagger is sentenced to 3 months in jail for possession of amphetamines, not meth, but amphetamines. And Keith Richards is sentenced to 1 year for allowing his home to be used for cannabis. they appeal the decision. What's interesting is the press, the regular press, is outraged by this. The London Times publishes an editorial that's called "Who Breaks a Butterfly on the Wheel?" That gets public outrage against how overreaching this trial was. And it changed public perception. And the Stones, the two guys, Richards and Jagger, their sentences are overturned. A couple of months after that, though, Brian Jones gets arrested for drugs as well. Also during this time in 67, he's called out for not being particularly nice to his girlfriend at the time. I think he was actually, I shouldn't say it that flippantly, he was abusing her.
Yeah.
And she ends up leaving him for Keith Richards.
Yeah. And he has a long relationship with her.
He does. So Richards is dating Brian Jones's girlfriend. Richards and Jagger are writing songs and taking a lot of the attention away from Brian Jones. Brian Jones starts to slide deeper and deeper into alcohol and drug use.
Well, a lot of times in a band, when you start dating the other guy's woman, that's...
That happened to the Ramones.
Yeah.
Go across
the problems. Ramones...
But that's sick, because they were all brothers.
Yeah, another thing that's happening during this time is Luke Oldham is also having his own problems with alcohol and drugs, and he's not exactly paying as much attention to the Rolling Stones as they would like for him to be paying it.
Right. Well, and that's the background going into this album before the one that we're going to talk about tonight, which is their Satanic Majesty's Request. So all of this is going on while they go in to record this album. Not to mention they decide to take a bit of a shift and embrace this psychedelic stuff, which is essentially what, when the album comes out, everyone's like, this is nothing but a poor attempt to piggyback on the Beatles' success. I think that's great in spite of Jagger singing on it because of the piano.
Yeah.
That's a great song.
That is a great song. And that was the arrangement. String arrangements were done by
John Paul Jones.
John Paul Jones. And the piano player is?
Oh.
Well, Liberace.
You better get your Connections music playing here, Doug. Who's the piano player, JM?
Nicky Hopkins.
Oh, yeah. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen. How does this album connect to previous albums we've talked about?
Doobie, doobie, doobie. Do you have any connections, Doug, before I move on to JM?
Phil Kaufman.
Okay.
Don't know that.
I love a blank look when I do connections. Well, if you ever need your body burned in... Joshua Tree National Park, he's your man. And during the portion of this album recorded in California, he is Mick Jagger's valet, although we're in America, so they don't call it that.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's how he got into the whole deal.
Is that how Graham ends up meeting, Graham Parsons ends up meeting him, is during that?
They all take off, and he can't go because he's on parole, which would shock most people to find out he was on parole. But he was unable to go, and Graham hires him to be his road manager. Huh. And he says, how do you do that? And he goes, just do what you were doing for Nick.
So what's except
we move while we do it.
So that's the connection is with Graham Parsons.
And we did Graham Parsons when we did the
Sweet Radio. All right, JM, do you have a connection?
I'm going to go with one not so obvious, perhaps. Rick Gretsch.
Ah, yes. And how is he connected?
He was the bass player for Blind Faith, which we talked about in a previous episode. And he was also the violin player. He plays violin on this, or fiddle, I believe is what he's credited with.
Well, it is a fiddle that he plays. Yeah. There's a distinction to, and most Texans, real Texans, know what the distinction is. And this, when he plays on this, it's a fiddle. All right.
Wasn't he in Family also?
I'm going to talk about that. So Dave Mason is also on this album.
And we did two appearances on this album.
We did Dave Mason's
Alone Together,
his debut album. This is how they get Jimmy Miller to produce this album, is Dave Mason was working on producing the Family album that has Rick Gretsch on it, and Jimmy Miller was helping him with that. And so that's how he gets introduced to the Stones to produce Beggar's Banquet. Mm-hmm. All right. Any other connections?
Glenn Johns.
All right, man.
he is the engineer on this album. He's engineered The Who. And he was a co-producer on the
Well, Who's who's next. He working with when the Rolling Stones roll in?
The Beatles?
Stevie Guitar Miller. Is that another right? connection, ladies and gentlemen.
Ah, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Do you?
That was my other one.
You know more? Okay,
I'll have some that I'll say, oh, yeah, I forgot.
So I'm going to talk about this because this is something we actually mentioned in another episode. So post this album, the Stones do a concert film that's going to be on the BBC called The Rock and Roll Circus. And on that bill are a bunch of people, Eric Clapton, John Lennon, The Who, Jethro Tull. Right. Plays on that, and we mentioned that particular episode or during our Jethro Tull Aqualung episode, we mentioned the Rock and Roll Circus.
And isn't the guitar player Tommy Iommi on that?
That's why I think we mentioned it. You're right. Tommy Iommi plays with Jethro Tull on... Thank you, JM. Yeah. I'd forgotten about that. Tommy Iommi from...
Black Sabbath.
So there's another connection.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Nicky Hopkins because we mentioned him and then we didn't talk about how he's connected.
Well, he's played on a lot of albums.
So I want to mention this. Yeah. So Nicky Hopkins, who's the piano player on this, he played. So the specific albums we talked about that he's been on were Village Green Preservation Society, Who's Next, Truth by the Jeff Beck Group, Brave New World by Steve Miller. He was particularly on, it was a Calculator, I think he plays on that song. He's also, now I want to go into bands we've talked about that he's played with, because this is fascinating. He's played with Badfinger, Harry Nilsson, Graham Parker, Mark Bolan, Jerry Garcia, Carl Wilson, Jefferson Airplane, The Beatles, Belinda Carlisle of the Go-Go's, Matthew Sweet, The Jayhawks, Spinal Tap, and he was on an album called Jamming with Edward, which is a 1972 album that has Mick Jagger, Charlie Watts, Bill Wyman, accompanied by Ry Cooter. So it's fascinating how that
we should do a record by him, and we could do the whole the whole show could just be connections.
Anyway,
they call him the greatest
session player
of all time, or something.
Well, listen to the song we just played. I mean that song is great because he's on it.
Yeah, and he plays beautifully on this album. I think we're talking about tonight, but he.
It sounds like he gets whatever he wants in the studio. He's really high thought of.
Yeah, unfortunately, he passed away in the mid-90s, not from, drug use or anything like that. He was supposedly a very professional person, but he had a congenital intestinal ailment, and I think it also killed his brother. And they both died. It wasn't the most pleasant.
People who don't act poorly in this business shouldn't die. They ought to get...
Right.
Provide a contrast.
Yeah.
Real quick before we scoop off of their Satanic Majesty's request, a bit of controversy about that album too. One of the proposed covers was to have Jagger naked on the cross.
And that's controversial.
Well, that was scrapped for being in bad taste.
Thank God.
While that album was later kind of given the bum's rap because of how much people thought it was derivative of what the Beatles were going, it hit number three in the UK and number two in the US. It just didn't have any staying power because people started feeling it wasn't really what the Stones should be doing.
Even the Stones disparaged. I mean, Mick Jagger, I don't think they played any of the songs off of it until that 89 tour.
Right. So... what's important about the other thing I forgot to mention about the last album, there's a Satanic Majesty's Request.
That's the first one they produced.
It's the only one they self-produced, and it's because Oldman left. He left managing them. He just gave up and walked away.
Yeah.
So they're left without this guy who was kind of a big part of it, and
he heard what they were playing. He goes, "I just don't like this." Right. And he just said, "I can't do anything with this." And yeah, they're kind of in a no man's land at this point, and so they decide this next album they really want to get focused. I heard that Keith Richards himself was really wanting to work, and they were actually coming up with. They weren't going to just write songs in the studio. And so they really wanted to find a good producer. And so they found this guy, Jimmy Miller, who had worked with, mentioned Traffic. His first thing that he mixed was Spencer Davis Group, Give Me Some Lovin'.
Yep. He did a good job.
So he started off as a drummer. And he comes from a pretty interesting background. His father was an entrepreneur. And he was in the entertainment industry. He started booking bands into Vegas. So, and he's kind of the person that's responsible for the big shows and everything that you see in Vegas now.
His dad was. Well, that's kind of cool.
So he, and his big coup de grace was when he got Elvis booked at the, I can't remember where he was playing, but so he kind of grew up around just seeing a whole bunch of these musicians, and he came under the tutelage of this guy Stanley Borden from RKO Records, and Borden was financing a new label run by Chris Blackwell.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Okay.
So Borden introduces Miller to Chris Blackwell. I guess that's another connection.
Yep.
Jimmy Miller starts becoming kind of the house engineer for these bands that are being signed to Island Records.
Well, that makes sense why he's doing Traffic and
the first thing he mixed was Give Me Some Lovin' by the Spencer Davis Group. He and Steve Winwood hit it off. Winwood just absolutely loves his production. So he brings Jimmy Miller in on Traffic. And so Miller starts producing the Traffic
album. Those Traffic albums sound fantastic, yeah, I think.
He's a great engineer. And so then he did Blind Faith. He also did songs by The Move. I didn't realize until we were doing this. Delaney and Bonnie and Spooky Tooth.
I don't know who Spooky Tooth is.
Spooky Tooth has what's his name from Foreigner and Gary Wright.
But they don't sound like Foreigner. They're good. They're good rock and roll band.
Well, that's another thing that makes that interesting is some of the members of Spooky Tooth went on to play with George Harrison on All Things Must Pass.
Which is all these things are starting to Delaney and Bonnie on us.
Yeah. So by the time Beggar Banquet is coming around, you know, Jimmy Miller is kind of an in-demand producer. But he was also known for his drinking and partying ways, which kind of endeared him to Keith Richards. So he just kind of thought that there would be this kind of fun atmosphere in the studio. And apparently it was. So not only was he producing and engineering the Stones, but he plays the cowbell on Honky Tonk Women. He plays drums on You Can't Always Get What You Want, Happy, and Tumbling Dice, three of my favorite songs by the Stones. Here's another interesting piece of trivia. His half-sister is Judith Miller, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who had to go to jail for that CIA Plame thing when they outed the Valerie Plame for being a CIA agent. So she actually went to jail for a few months because she wouldn't reveal her sources.
Wow.
Unfortunately, he died the mid-90s from liver failure. He was married, and his wife had passed away from breast cancer, and he was just kind of a mess after that. So,
Well, thanks for
giving every us, time JM talks about someone,
they're die. A mess. Yeah, thanks for getting us up to speed on that. I think fundamentally important that one of the big distinctions between Andrew Lou Goldman and Jimmy Miller was Jimmy Miller knew his way around an instrument.
Yeah,
and Andrew Lou Goldman was all about the packaging of
right. What he was more on. A manager than a producer.
Right.
They kind of back in those days. They kind of the manager and the producer were kind of.
The record industry was very very.
Let's just say. You wouldn't want to try to defend their Christian witness.
Right. But, you know, we talked about this. I'm just going to mention it again. So they're sliding into going in to record this album, Beggar's Banquet, and they've got a problem with Brian Jones. We'll just talk about the issues as the songs come up because I think that'll be a little bit more organic. But a couple of things we need to talk about before we get into talking about the album is the cover.
Well, if you look at the cover that actually is on most releases now, it's the one that they originally wanted, and it's the credits for the album are written on the bathroom wall. So it's a toilet and graffiti on the in a wall in a public bathroom, and if you look closely, it's the credits for the album.
And a lot of other things.
Was that choice because they wanted to be shocking? I mean, what's the deal with the...
Mick Jagger was out with the art director, whoever he was, and they were talking about fame. Mm-hmm. And he goes, if you ever get famous enough to be written on a bathroom wall, you're at the top.
Okay.
So that's where it came from. Mick Jagger loved the idea.
Yeah.
And they went to, I think it's a Porsche dealership or a mechanic, and it's the bathroom in that shop.
Is that right?
And... Mick Jagger and Keith Richards went in there wearing their get-ups, their like velvet pants and all this kind of stuff. They go into this nasty, nasty bathroom with junk all over the ground. And Jagger's horrified. Richards thinks it's hilarious. And after a while, they relax and they start goofing off in there. And then they erase some things and add some things. Mm-hmm. And I watched a very detailed movie about this. It's actually three movies, and the guy, this is how detailed it was, he read everything on that wall.
Really?
And that took most of my trip over here today. I think it's brilliant. I also think it's ugly.
Yeah,
it's very- but there's so many things to read on there. Ronald Reagan's on there. Mm-hmm. All kinds of symbols and names. And, of course, all the songs are on there.
Yeah.
The credits are on there.
You do have to look pretty closely.
Well, and it's not something pleasant to spend time looking at.
No.
So,
and they were actually written on there. So this is...
The label refuses to release that album cover. That's what we're getting at. And Jagger and Richards refused to let them not release it. So this album was held up mainly because they really wanted that picture on there. Yeah. They end up acquiescing to the label eventually because, as Richard said later, admitted they needed the money. So they end up, what's released is a very plain album cover that looks like an engraved invitation.
Yeah, it looks like a wedding invitation. Which right. It's an attractive album cover that in no way makes you think of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, or what you're about to listen.
You want to go to a country club for a wedding.
So the other thing, Jam, I want to talk about is this is the first album where Richards embraces open tuning.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I think he's big on open G tuning. You want to explain a little bit what that is?
Yeah, so open tuning is when you tune your guitar to a chord. So if you're just strumming it and not putting your fingers on any of the frets, it's actually making a chord. And there's a bunch of different ways you can do it. It's usually played a lot with slide guitar players. A lot of the songs that Keith Richards writes are in this open G tuning. Start Me Up is in that, Tumble and Dice, just a lot of the songs that you know the riffs from are done with this open G tuning that Keith Richards has.
Well, one of the things that I read that makes him unusual is when you mentioned slide guitars, most people use open tuning and they use it to play like bottleneck guitar or something, slide guitar. Yeah. He does it to play rhythm guitar,
right,
which makes what he does sound sound different than anything anybody else is doing.
Sounds, I mean, like if you try to play his stuff, a lot of his stuff in standard tuning, like Tumble and Dice, for instance.
It's a good song, by the way.
It's harder. I mean, he does it, and he also does it in Wild Horses, and also gives it a really full sound because you don't really have to bar that much.
He takes the top string off.
He plays five strings.
And he does that on this album at least once. What influenced him to get to this open tuning, evidently there were musicians around him who were saying, you really need to kind of change your technique a little bit. One of them was Gram Parsons, who talked him into doing it. Taj Mahal was another one.
Yeah. Well, those three were jamming together in L.A.
Yeah, Ry Cooder. Yeah.
All those guys were down there.
But, you know, an unusual name to see on that list of people who influenced him was Don Everly. Really? He said Don Everly was one of the best open tuning guitarists he'd ever heard.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
So I just found that fascinating. Yeah. JM, there's one person in particular we have not mentioned, and that's the guy who plays the congas.
Rocky Dijon. Yeah, he kind of had in the late 60s and early 70s, he was kind of the go-to guy for congas and a lot of various percussion things. He was born in Ghana, and he has worked with so many people. He worked with Rolling Stones, Nick Drake, Ginger Baker, Stevie Wonder, Billy Preston, who the Rolling Stones would eventually work with. And he also played with Bill Wyman on his solo album, 1976 solo album, Stone Alone. He died, unfortunately, in California about 30 years ago, but he had quite a run there.
Sam's like the angel of death.
I know.
All right, guys, so I think it's now time. People have been waiting for us to talk about this album and get into the songs. So we're going to start talking about Beggar's Banquet. The very first song on Beggar's Banquet is something that you've heard before, Sympathy for the Devil.
Sure, the pilot washed his hands and sealed his face. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game.
I think this is a pretty incredible song. It was written one way, and then he changed the lyrics after the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Well, it was originally Kennedy's single, and then Robert Kennedy was assassinated during, I guess, the recording of this, and so he changed it to Kennedy's. Question that we always ask, is this a great way to start the album, guys?
I think so.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious you have two songs you're going to start with.
I'm guessing Street Fighting Man is the other song, and they both, and that's the first song on the second side.
Yeah.
I don't hear another song other than Street Fighting Man that's a competitor for this one as far as starting out.
Yeah. I don't think this song was chart-wise, a big hit for them.
I don't think it was. I think it was later on that this...
Is it too hard to figure out what's going on if in 1968... This doesn't sound like anything else.
No, it really doesn't.
This was written by Jagger. It's mostly Jagger's song. We mentioned this earlier that Richard's contribution is changing up the rhythm. And it was originally a folk song or folk-ish. If you watch, there's a movie by Jean, is it, how do you say his name?
Godard.
Jean? Yeah, what?
Godard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
they show the making of this.
They show a lot of the studio stuff of this song, and we'll post a clip of it on the website. But they start off with Jagger and Keith Richards and Brian Jones sitting around a circle on the floor playing, and Jagger's trying to show the song to him, and it's very much a much more set of.
It sounds like Blonde on Blonde.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is what he was going for on this.
And then the movie you're talking about was a pretty big deal. It was called One Plus One, and it was...
I think it was called Sympathy for the Devil. And yeah,
it was a big deal. It's supposed to have two themes, one of creation and one of destruction, and it included a bunch of studio time with the Rolling Stones, and... contributed to a fire in the studio, in Olympic Studio. They had all kinds of hot lights. If you look at, you know, musicians hate to have a bright studio, and this thing looks like an operating room. And
I'm not sure Jagger minds having a bright light on him.
I thought the same thing. I bet they hated it. And I thought, No, this is probably a dream come true to have everybody paying attention to them. A lot of equipment was ruined by the firemen pouring water on everything. But the permanent damage to the studio was a hole in the ceiling or in the roof.
So, wow.
Whenever an airplane was going over, they had to quit recording.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. So this song is 6 minutes and 18 seconds long. It's a long song, and it does not change much.
No, it's jaunty. I don't know. There's such a galloping nature to this song that
And that's Keith Richards. Yeah. I mean, he not only did he change the rhythm, but he plays the bass on this, and the bass is fun. That's what's interesting about this song to me. Listening to it, I never really thought about it. There's not any guitar really in it until the lead stuff. And Brian Jones is playing the acoustic on this, but they took him out of the mix. So who knows what that sounded like.
Yeah.
But
and then you have the piano that just puts in like a measure and then just steps out. And there's some.
I want to talk about that guitar solo, because to me, it's got that kind of evil snarl the way that he plays it.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who don't believe that's Richards playing the guitar.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of people say it's Jimmy Page.
It wouldn't surprise me if it is, but man.
The other person they mentioned is Roy Buchanan.
I could also see that.
Roy Buchanan, I think, tried out for them when Brian Jones left, but it was not a good fit. Yeah. And you can see why.
People would accuse my guitar work of being Roy Buchanan.
Well, and this is considered by a lot of people to be Keith Richards' best guitar solo.
Yeah, and it's one of the few that you can actually say, this is a guitar solo.
Yeah.
I think it's a very compelling guitar solo. It's one of the most interesting things about
this. If you pull the solo out on its own and listen to it, it's not that technically competent to me. I think the reason why it stands out so much is because it breaks the monotony of the song up. It's something you're like not expecting, and it pops out. I'm not saying it's bad. I'd put that on the record.
I think it's almost irritating. I think if he had played it much longer, it would have been irritating.
Well, it's got that really high. It's like that really trebly high sound.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like nails on a chalkboard. It's not meant to be calming.
No.
It does have one of the things that makes Keith Richards a good guitarist, and that's space.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would have
continued to play.
They wouldn't stop. He stops much the same way the piano stops in the first part of the...
Yeah.
He's just a phrase here, a phrase there, and he doesn't overdo it, especially with that biting sound that his guitar has.
Yeah.
This song was recorded six different ways,
and
the one that we hear is the one they chose.
Keith Richards talks a lot about how this is why he doesn't like people coming into the studio with a completed song. He believes that you need to have that freedom to kind of riff and jive and do whatever you're doing in the studio to create something out of that. So he loves it, putting this up as an example. This song is why we don't come in complete when we do with albums.
Well, it sure did morph a lot in the process.
Let's talk a bit about the subject matter, because I think that's equally as compelling. So it was based on a novel by I'm going to screw this guy's name up.
Mikhail
Bulgakov. Called Master and Margarita. And in that book, evidently, it's a struggles of good and evil. It tells the story of Satan in Moscow in the 1930s.
Well, there's an episode in the book that sounds a little bit like this. There's two atheists sitting at a bench.
Yeah, they're sitting at a bench.
And they're talking about a poem about Jesus. And he says, your poem makes it seem too real. And he says that Jesus didn't really exist. And right at that point, this guy walks up and says, no, I was there.
He says, permit me to introduce myself, is what he says to him. Yeah. Which is important. Where you get that, please allow me to.
And that book was given to Jagger by Marianne
Faithfull. Yeah,
girlfriend.
So, who was his girlfriend at the time, right? So,
just been translated, too.
The song takes us kind of in a very brief history of historical atrocities, if you will. I mean,
it was written over 10 years. I think it was finished in the 30s, and then it disappeared. And
Bolsheviks didn't like it.
The Soviets didn't like some things that were written. And
well, he does
reappeared in right before this album.
just going back to the song, it's a historical account of sort of a brief historical account of certain atrocities. One, it starts off, we're talking about the trial and death of Jesus. It mentions the Russian Revolution. I think it's interesting that a song in 1968 paints the revolutionaries as the ones on the wrong side of history.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. It talks about the German army during World War II. And then we mentioned the assassination of the Kennedys. There's a couple of things I want to mention about lyrically in this. One is I find it fast. The thing I like about it is how nonchalantly the devil's talking about stuff. And a good example is that where he says, I stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it was time for a change. I mean, just mentioning it's time for a change, just tossing that off, I think is really a kind of a brilliant lyric. One of the things that's always bugged me about it is the second verse is 6 lines. Every other verse is 8 lines. And every time hear that second verse, I'm expecting 2 more lines and they're not there.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's the case? And that's, I believe,
that's where the piano starts coming in, I think.
Yeah, but it's a weird, I mean, I don't know why he did it unless he just couldn't think of 2 more lines. And unless it's an artistic choice. That's what I was going to ask you guys about, if you felt anything about that.
Yeah, but it is noticeable. You're right.
He talks about the first 2 lines are about the Russian Revolution. The second line is about World War II and the Blitzkrieg. And he stops at the Blitzkrieg, the stinking bodies or whatever that line is. The other question I have about is the word sympathy.
I've never understood.
Well, isn't it? You should be sympathetic you should have sympathy for the devil since it's you.
I think that's exactly what it is. That's what I take out of it.
Well, because it's you, me. And
I think
you,
that's right? Exactly.
Well, the theme of the song.
I think that's exactly where there's that's coming from. Is the sympathy is?
I never thought about that.
There's no belief in a devil in this song. The devil is simply a personification
he's talking
of
about
mankind.
Yeah.
Why didn't Bill Wyman play the bass on this song?
I didn't hear an answer to that.
I don't know.
Was he not in the? I know there were times he wasn't in the studio.
He was there. He's playing.
Playing the little deal that you go like this, ladies and gentlemen. If you were here to see, I'm shaking my hand. Anyway, it's not.
And then there's that scene in that movie, the Godard movie, your clip we talked about, where it shows Jagger isolated singing the lyrics, and then you've got 1,700 people standing around a mic going woo woo.
That is Keith Richards organized the woohooers.
You got Marianne Faithfull, and then Anita Pallenberg, his girlfriend.
Nicky Hopkins is in there. Brian Jones, Bill Wyman, Charlie Watts, and Keith Richards.
Yeah.
The guy that designed the album cover said he's in there. I think lyrically it's a very good song.
I think it is.
I think it's the production is very, very forward thinking. I mean, it's hugely original is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I will.
It doesn't sound derivative.
I'm going to tip my hat to the Stones. I think as much as I used to complain about how I think they jumped on bandwagons, and they do that. I mean, everybody does that. Bowie did that. Oh, this is the next new thing. Let me be part of that. Doing this particular podcast made me realize they're innovators in ways that I wasn't really giving them credit for.
Yeah.
And they're doing stuff that, as you said, sounds like nothing.
Right.
Sounds like nothing that's going on at the time. You're right. This does not sound like 1968. All right. Next song, No Expectations, song 2, side 1.
Take me to the station and put me on the train. I've got no expectations.
It's such a beautiful, delicate song. I love it. It's one of my.
I like the song a lot, and I think it's very necessary after Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah.
This is my favorite song on the album.
It's the most melodic.
Well, and just for, and I'm not going to knock Jagger because he sounds good on it. My biggest problem with the Stones is mainly him. But imagine this song with Jay Farrar singing it. It sounds like a Sunvolt song to me. I hear this and I'm like, okay, bands I listen to were heavily influenced by this band, and this is a prime example of it. This song is fantastic.
You know, Towns could do a good job on it.
Yeah,
and let's give credit where credit's due. This song is fantastic because Brian Jones is playing the slide guitar on it, and it adds so much to this song.
So what I read about that, well, first of all, this is supposed to be the last real contribution
Mick Jagger calls it.
Well, and it's a contribution it is.
Yeah. This is the last contribution by Brian Jones that sounds like Brian Jones.
Yeah, and they said that they were all sitting around on the floor. Keith Richards and Jagger were just throwing out songs, and Brian Jones was just kind of sitting there not doing anything. And then they started playing this song, and Brian Jones, that's like live. That's Brian Jones sitting there just sitting there playing it. Cause, and he said, that's how you perked up when he heard this song.
That's the open E tuning that he has.
And it's so nice to hear Jagger sing, like, not be so over the top on something. His vocals are perfect on this song.
And he could so easily.
Yeah.
Put my out of the train.
Yeah.
Baby.
I it's odd because I didn't know he was capable of subtlety like this, to be honest with you. But this is a great song. It was originally called Side Doodles. That was a working title of it. The thing I love about it is how everything about it just evokes this kind of sad nostalgia.
Yeah.
The piano, the slide, the lyrics. Yeah. Dude.
There's not really any drums on it. The percussion is so
light. The bass is great on this song.
The bass is an upright bass.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is. There's supposedly an organ someplace in the mix, but I don't know where that is.
But it's an ode to Robert Johnson, isn't it? They were trying to do like a Robert Johnson style song. So that's the reason why it's got the train, like Train in Vain or... What? Not training.
You're talking about the Clash now.
What's that song they do? They do another song later that's a Robert Johnson cover that's got the word train in it, and that's what they were.
Well, I didn't know that. I just assumed the train and the plane were ways for this poor narrator to get the hell out of Dodge because he's leaving. I mean, he's heartbroken and he's got to leave. And yeah. I didn't know it was a Robert Johnson. It makes sense. It's a country blues song. And fantastic version of one. I mean, this song is great. I love this song. I could listen to the song. I did listen to it over and over again. It was hard for me not to repeat it.
Robert Johnson's song is Love in Vain.
And that's why you said Train in Vain.
Yeah, it's Love in. And so they used to cover that song before they actually recorded it. And
okay.
So apparently Brian Jones really liked that song, and so that was kind of like Mick Jagger was going, okay, let's keep going. We got him. Let's keep it going.
It's just, I don't even want to move on because I love that song so much. But move on we shall. And the next song is the third song on side one, Dear Doctor.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart.
Is Graham Parsons having an influence on them?
I think so.
Yeah, but here's a prime example of Jagger kind of overdoing it, I think.
I agree with you. And I wish he hadn't done that affected female. So,
that weird Southern accent.
But it sounds like he's doing, what's the one with, I ran 13 miles. Red lights in his honor.
Yeah.
The girl with faraway eyes.
Yeah, faraway eyes, yeah.
I have mixed feelings about this song because I do like it musically. I mean, it's what's not to like, but Jagger's vocals just kind of take me out of it because they're so over the top.
Well, yeah, and he's trying to make it, it sounds like it's Appalachian, you know, it sounds like, and it's about a guy being left at the altar by his bride to be.
He's not too unhappy about that
because it's the happiest one person ever left at the altar.
Because if you're talking about again that kind of dirtiness of a Stone song, the way he describes this poor woman isn't exactly pleasant. What does he call her, a fat sow or something like that?
Yeah. It's a happy ending,
yeah,
because he doesn't have to marry her, he's going to see the doctor because he has to marry her, but it's almost like it's a throwaway novelty song.
It is because they get, when he goes to reading the note, he does that goofy that falsetto.
I'm sorry to hurt you.
That wasn't in the original, by the way.
That was
No, this is the song that Wyman plays a stand-up bass on. I don't think it's the last one.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and it's in triple time, and Nicky Hopkins uses a tack piano. Jam, what's a tack piano?
Tack piano is a like a regular piano, only they literally put tacks in between the strings, so it makes it sound like it's one of those old-timey Western bar.
It gives the piano like a percussive sound, right?
Yeah, a tinny percussive piano. Sound.
Yeah. Did y'all notice it changes keys? And it's kind of subtle how they do it, but it when that walk-up, on the guitar, when it's doing that, when you call it filigree, I think is what it's called, and it walks up and it stays in the key that he walked up to. So that, I don't know, I thought that's kind of cool.
You know, we've talked about people kind of being out of their element when they try to write songs about things they don't maybe don't have a whole lot of historical context about. Jagger does not know what bourbon tastes like. I've never heard bourbon called sour in my life. And I just think it's funny that
maybe he's thinking of sour mash.
Sour mash doesn't make whiskey sour.
No.
So,
but maybe he said he doesn't know what he's talking about, but he says bourbon and sour mash basically the same thing.
Yeah, you give him credit and say the reason it tastes sour is because he's trying to get drunk to forget what he has to do, which is marry this poor woman.
I don't know. Sour mash is what they call whiskey that isn't in Bourbon County.
Yeah, it's just funny. Maybe he's just trying to rhyme with the word hour too. Who knows? Yeah.
We don't sit around writing songs about Scotch whiskey. Not knowing what we're talking about. We at least do some homework on them.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to the next song, we got Parachute Woman, which is song number 4 on side one,
and it's featured just above the toilet.
Song, it's just kind of pretty much a straight, Mississippi blues song, and I really like the production on it. It doesn't sound like any of the instruments are actually close mic'd. It seems like they're just kind of out in the space, and there's like one microphone drop down.
You don't know how this was recorded on a Philips EL3302 initially.
Yeah, a cassette player?
It's a little handheld cassette player.
Yeah. And then they put it inside an echo chamber.
Right. And then they overdubbed it over again. It. Right. Yeah. So that's why it sounds like that, yeah. I'm mixed about this. I will say this. Prior to doing this podcast, I would have outright hated this song. Now I just kind of find it mildly irritating. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but it's Jagger's delivery on it just sounds so, I don't know what he's.
I understand what you're.
He's like this affected kind of weirdness that he does. Just sing the song.
He has a difficult time singing anything straight, I think. I think he's just constantly trying to hide. And if you ever hear him interviewed, especially when they are trying to ask him about his songs, he's very self-deprecating about them. He doesn't like talking about the lyrics that he's written. And because he just, they're just things to, hang notes off of, I think is the way that he put it. Hmm.
I thought about this about a week now since we've been approaching this album. And I decided that Mick Jagger looks like his voice more than anybody else.
He does. Yeah.
That's hilarious. I also find I don't find the lyrics provocative. Maybe it's because I'm 54 looking at them. They just seem goofy to me.
Well, we live in a world that it's hard to be provocative. Look at your latest rap things. There's nothing. There's no attempt to hide what they're talking about anymore. Right.
And I don't. And again, this is on me. So everybody's listening. We don't need to send me hate mail. But I'm not sure why. If Plant was singing this, it wouldn't bother me the way it does this song.
Huh. Well, I can't say that. I think when you have a blues, you're already hearing music that's not new.
Yeah.
So there needs to be something new in the mix. And in American blues singers, usually that's guitar or an extraordinary voice that's really good at expression. The thing about Jagger's voice, it reminds me of David Lee Roth's voice. And I don't mean that they sound the same.
There's just no subtlety to it.
And there's like gorilla howler monkey yells. And even when they're singing, it's almost like a shout sometimes. Yeah. If David Lee Roth is capable of sweetening up and doing She's a Rainbow or His Tears Go By, we haven't heard that before. But they both have something about the wild man on stage going, whoo! I don't like that very much.
I don't either.
I'm not fond of that kind of singing or whatever they call it.
You know, to be honest with you, I've seen the Stones twice, and I've, you know, I've watched them a lot on TV and everything. Jagger kind of drives me crazy on stage because he doesn't stand. He never is standing still, and he's constantly like putting his hand down.
Well, too many practice maneuvers. Yeah. It reminds me of that picture of Hitler that they had, the black and white pictures of Hitler practicing his gestures.
If you watch that video of them doing Sympathy for the Devil and he's isolated, I don't know if it's because he knows the camera's on him or what, but he's shaking like he's having a fit while he's singing that.
Yeah.
I don't know where that's coming from.
That was a lot more to talk about that song than it deserved.
Yeah.
All right. Jigsaw Puzzle is the next one.
There's a tramp sitting on my doorstep, trying to waste his time with his methylated sandwich. He's a walking clothesline. And here comes the bishop's daughter.
And the rabbit with the underbite.
This isn't one of my favorite songs that they've ever done, but I do like it, and I think I would like it more if it weren't so long. I don't think it needs to be anywhere near this long.
Well, even Richard said the song is too long.
Yeah.
And it's made longer by the lack of resignation.
It's just
you're hanging the whole time. He doesn't end on the tonic.
They never do. Yeah. Doesn't seem like they ever hit.
I like his voice in this.
It's better. It's definitely better.
It's doing something a little bit new.
Yeah. I don't hear him sing like this very often. Mm-mm. It also has the Mellotron on it.
Does. It has Brian Jones. And it's interesting when it comes in because it's not doing anything other than the kind of a high-pitched whine.
Yeah, that whine.
Which reminds me of Highway 61 Revisited and the stacking of the lyrics the way they are.
Well, this song was another Dylan-esque sort of surrealistic.
That's why the
illustration.
He's just sitting around working a jigsaw puzzle while something's going on, and he's just
that's a typical Dylan thing, right? A character is kind of surrounded by a bunch of craziness.
In actuality, it's his girlfriend who was working on the jigsaw puzzle when he wrote this.
That's right. So, yeah,
Richards plays the acoustic, electric rhythm, and the slide on this song. All three.
I think we realized that maybe he should let Brian Jones play slide. That's one of the things that kind of drives me crazy on
it. I don't know that he was available, probably.
Yeah. Well, he plays the Mellotron on it.
See, he wasn't available. He's on the Mellotron.
And I'm guessing that line, I mean, it's fairly obvious, the line about the singer and the bass player, that's sort of semi-autobiographical, I'm assuming. Yeah. I don't know. The song's too long. As you said, it's just sort of monotonous. And
Yeah, it could have been the bass on it is really cool. You got, I guess that, because the bass starts going towards the end of the song. But
I don't think it has a bridge, does it?
No.
Anything to break it up. Yeah. If you're going to go, you know, that's one thing I'm just realizing right now. The Rolling Stones are good at going long without breaking up their, you can break it up any number of ways, but if you don't, That's what JM said earlier about the importance of the guitar solo in Sympathy for the Devil. Because if it doesn't come in...
That's what I said. It breaks the monotony of that. Yeah.
That's very important.
And this just goes into some outro that I find boring as all get out, too.
Here we are at outros again with Tony. We better move on.
All right. Well, and this is the last song on the first side. Not a strong way to end, if you ask me.
I agree.
But we flip it over and we get a pretty darn good song. Street Fightin' Man, side two.
This is one of my all-time favorite Rolling Stones songs. I absolutely love this song. It's got that kind of Martha and the Vandellas dancing in the streets kind of sound.
The wall of sound.
Yeah. But you know, I think this is one of the songs that they recorded on that cassette player and fed through the main speakers and then overdubbed. I think they did it twice.
Yeah, that Philips tape recorder again. Yeah. And he said what he did is Richards overloaded his acoustic through it so it sounded like an electric guitar.
Yeah.
It was played in open D tuning. I think you had mentioned that, Doug. Mm-hmm. That he used that on this album. And Charlie Watts plays a toy drum set on this too, which also gave it a distorted sound.
He said it was like tambourines with the metal parts taken off.
And then they transferred it to the A-track by playing it through a mic, which also did stuff to it. Yeah. And then they did their overdubs
When they got to Sunset Studios, when they had a little more equipment.
Yeah.
And Sunset Studios doesn't get credit on the original album.
Is that right?
Yeah. Huh. So
this is also one of the songs where Keith Richards plays the 5-string guitar. He takes a string off an open G tuning, and he plays the bass on it too, because Wyman wasn't available at this point, and plays the bass. Brian Jones plays a sitar on it and a tambora.
Yeah. So a tambora is, in this particular case, it is a instrument that's not designed to be played at any sort of melody. It's just supposed to be creating a drone behind it. So they use it in Within Without You on Sgt. Pepper's, so that it's usually played along with the sitar, so it gives it that sort of drone-y film.
Well, that makes sense that he did it both. Jagger double tracks his vocals.
Yeah.
I think his vocals work on this song.
I do too.
In a way that they don't always do.
I'm listening to it trying to figure out, okay, Jagger's sick. Who do you put in? And it's not obvious who put in.
I think
but it has to be another hollering guy.
Yeah.
I
think the opening is the best part of the whole song.
It's good. Bizarre. It's compelling.
He uses that again.
That one drum coming in the way it does is so strong.
Yeah.
And it just builds. And then you got this big, powerful thing. I think the chorus lacks the power.
Yeah, really?
The verses.
Huh.
Well, and this was also the song that Dave Mason's on.
Yeah.
He plays the...
It's a clarinet type instrument.
Yeah, the Chennai, I guess, or is it some Indian clarinet? And he plays the bass drum on it, too.
Why in the world does he know how to play that?
I don't know.
Bizarre.
Bizarre.
Think about like the beginning of London Calling.
Mm-hmm.
It's that a little bit of that. It's not something you could really hum. But it's this sort of wall of sound. Mm-hmm. It's this marching drone.
Yeah.
That it reminds, it's a real powerful thing. But when you get to the chorus, what can it pour? It's kind of, that monolith kind of collapses. It starts doing the shimmy or something, and it loses a little bit of its power. Not that it's a bad chorus.
But I love when he says that street fighting man and those. That
he goes back. That's when it returns.
The sitar and all that stuff starts coming
so,
in.
Yeah.
But street fighting man, it's just like he gets back into his march.
Yeah.
This song wasn't as big of a hit as it should have been because it was banned in a lot of places.
Yeah.
It was banned in the UK for fear of causing... Riot. Issues
causing the things that inspired it.
It was released right after in the US. It was released as a single right after the 1968 Democratic Convention, which we've talked about previously. And there's a lot of violence involved in that. And mm-hmm. radio stations in Chicago wouldn't play it because they also thought it would.
Well, this
start
is
things going.
68's violent.
Yeah, it was a Prague Spring. I think he was talking about what was going over.
Yeah, Prague Spring. When the Soviets rolled the tanks into everybody else.
Second French Revolution or whatever they call it.
The French were fired up. Yeah. And then in the United States, we have MLK getting killed, which caused...
Kennedy.
Kennedy. Second Kennedy gets killed. We had a lot of Vietnam War protests.
And then the Democratic Convention. Yeah. The song wasn't released in the UK till 71 as a single.
Wow. Which one's a more apparent hit, this or Sympathy for the Devil?
It's tough. I think this one.
I do, too. I like this one more. Like I said,
I do
this
too.
Is one of my favorite songs.
It doesn't have the... I mean, I think Sympathy for the Devil is a great song, but I think it you need... that guitar, you need something to break it. This doesn't seem to have that issue. Like this is
no, it's that again, it reminds me of London Calling, where there's just something so compelling about the march. Like,
You're right. Yeah.
Well, just think if they put ooh-hoos at the end of this one, how inappropriate that would be.
Well, what's funny is because he does the same sort of tricks with this song that he does on Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Yeah.
And you can hear Jumpin' Jack Flash. It has that same sort of sound going on to it.
It just doesn't keep going.
No. Yeah, a Jumpin' Jack Flash is an acoustic guitar overloaded, like you were just saying. Yeah.
Which is a great sound.
It is.
Acoustic guitars played into amps with distortion, they sound really good.
I know.
It's not done.
It's not done very much.
I think people who play electric guitar, they get lazy because it's so much easier to press the strings and bend the strings.
All right. Moving on to the only song that was not written by a member of the Rolling Stones, Prodigal Son.
Poor boy, took his father's bread, started down the road, started down the road. All he had started down the road. Went out in his world, well, God only knows. And that would be the way to get along. Well, poor boy, all he had.
God bless Mick Jagger, he's trying so hard.
He's trying to do that mealy mouth Mississippi blues.
He's trying so
man.
Hard.
I love the guitar.
The song is fantastic.
I enjoy it. And I'm thinking about how, if I could play something that clear, how stuck up I would be. And then Mick comes in there and I'm going, why is this white English guy trying to sing this song?
Yeah.
This should be.
It should be Muddy Waters.
You can hear the original.
You know, John Lee Hooker should be singing it.
So,
Robert, this would be someone who's wearing their first pair of shoes at 60. Yeah.
So, it's written by a guy named Robert Wilkins. He first recorded it in 1929 when he was a blues singer, and it's called, that version was called That's No Way to Get Along. Later on, he finds God and becomes a preacher, and he uses the same chord progression and guitar arrangement to write a song called Prodigal Son that was released on a gospel album called Memphis Gospel Singer. And that was in the 60s sometime. And that's what the Stones did. What's interesting about this is the Stones got called out later for co-opting this song and not giving them credit. But from what I understand,
the
original album cover, the one that they wanted to use, actually credited Wilkins for the song. And when the label changed it, they put it on as a Jagger's Richards composition.
Mm.
Yeah. You would think, though, the band would have seen that and said, that's wrong. Can we at least correct that part of it? But whatever.
And the other thing that's kind of cool about this is I think that's just Charlie Watts playing a snare drum with brushes. And then I don't know who's playing this. It's not a kick drum. I think it's a bass drum. Somebody's hitting. It may be Jagger. I think I read that Jagger plays bass drum on this. So. But somebody's banging that bass drum in the back.
He should have just done the bass drum. Let somebody else sing that.
Yeah. Hell, I think this is almost be a good one for Keith to sing.
Well, we'll get to Keith singing.
Yeah,
in a moment,
get to that.
But all right, next song is a lovely, lovely sentiment. Stray Cat Blues.
There is just something so primal about this song that I just find fascinating. I hate to say it because the subject matter is terrible, but it's one of my favorite songs by them. And the drumming is incredible. I love the guitar work on it. The bass playing is phenomenal.
Well, you should like it. It's essentially a ripoff of Heroin by the Velvet Underground.
Really?
They admit that.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, maybe that's why I do like both those songs quite a bit.
I like this song just exactly like I liked the last one.
Until
the singing. Yeah.
Well, the last one, at least, the lyrics aren't repulsive.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
This is, for those of you who are new to this, this is about a much older gentleman, likely a rock musician of some sort, trying to seduce a 15-year-old groupie.
Yeah.
You know, to his credit, Jagger corrected the age when he played it live in 69. He knocked 2 years off and made her 13 when he did that.
Oh, God. Jeez.
I you know, this has a long history in rock and roll and blues. How many people sang Little Schoolgirl?
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
I don't understand. Number one, if you thought, if you had that inclination, why the hell would you talk about it?
Right.
If you didn't have that inclination, why would you affect that you did? I just don't understand why this is a popular tune. You know, I used to have trouble with Van Morrison with right. So Young and Bold, just, but I figured out that the girl he's singing about her when he was the same age.
Yeah, it's like the song 13 by Big Star. That's not mm-hmm. about some old guy trying to get a 13-year-old. It's right. about a 13-year-old boy singing about his girlfriend who's 13.
Mm-hmm. There's not enough dads with shotguns in England, I guess.
Well, and, you know, I was going to say not sound prude, but I'm okay sounding prude about this. I've got two daughters. The last thing I want is to hear about a song about
this. I don't want hearing about anyone lusting after my daughter, you know, but it doesn't need to happen. It's such a primal.
Doesn't need to happen.
It does. I wish the subject matter were different, but
let's face it. This is not an outlier with the Stones.
No, it's not.
It's like I don't even believe this is an interest of his. It's like he wants to seek it out because pushing buttons or something.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's the same thing with the controversy over the album covers and all this stuff. It's all about, you know, making waves. And we talked about this with bands like the Sex Pistols. It just seems like wasted energy.
It is.
You know?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the things that I think causes more problems and less creativity in the world, and that is being anti-something. You should always be for something, and if you don't like something, just don't spend energy on it.
Right.
In politics right now, this is so clear. So much foolishness is focusing on what the other guy's doing and not focusing on what can be done.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It is kind of funny, though. I'm just thinking people are listening to this going, what, a bunch of old farts shaking their fists at the sky. But you know what? I'm okay with that. Yeah. I can be.
Well, that's what we're supposed to do. I waited a long time to become a grumpy old man.
Well,
you know what?
The club.
Yeah. What if we were up here going, like, anyway, what'd you think about Tupac Carew? And we would sound like idiots because we're out of our age. Just like if when we were 19, if we tried to do this, we'd sound like idiots.
Yeah.
So we're doing what we're supposed to. This is our calling.
Well, get out of my yard.
thankfully, we go to the next song, Factory Girl.
I like it.
It's one of my favorites on the album, and
I like the guitar playing. I like the drums.
Yeah,
they sound completely inappropriate when they first get in, and then I go, "Oh, but that's perfect." Like it.
I know it sounds. It's like Indian and mountain music mixed together. It's kind of like an Appalachian tune with the.
You can't ignore the Celtic vibe to this song too.
Yeah, very Celtic.
Yeah,
very
I love this song. It's my second favorite song on the album. I think Jagger's vocals are great on this song. Actually, they're perfect for them. I did keep thinking. I actually looked it up to see if it was possible. I was like, "What would this sound like if Shane McGowan had sung this song?" You know? And even the subject matter, I think, is great because, you know, we just got through talking about something like dirty. And here's a guy, the narrator, who's describing this girl who, by all accounts, is not pretty to look at. But to him, she's a sight for sore eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great song.
Yeah. And this is one that Rocky DeJean plays on. He's playing those congas.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the tabla in this. But the tabla is usually played with your hands, and you make these kind of, you fashion your hands in such a way to actually make kind of a swooping sound in it. But Charlie Watts isn't doing that. He's actually playing
with sticks. He said that's because it's really hard to play. Like the technique is absolutely impossible to play really with your tough hand.
Yeah.
It works.
And Dave Mason's on this song as well.
Playing mandolin.
Playing mandolin is great. And this is the song that's got Rick Gretsch playing violin as well on it. It's a really, really... I was thinking, you know, listening to this this song and No Expectations, what... And I'm not enough of a Stones fan to know if there's an entire album of songs like that, but how much I would love sitting in that space for an entire album. I think it would be great.
They do some stuff like that on Exile on Main Street. One of them isn't the best subject matter, but...
Be nice if they recorded some of their music in another language.
Well, and I don't want to also just gloss over the finger picking on this song as well. It's just great. I mean, everything about this song is so understated and it works so well.
It's a lot of people have a great affinity for this song. I think even the Stones have an affinity for this song because it does seem like they bring it up when they talk quite a bit. I mean, it's one of, I think Charlie Watts likes it, and he is notorious for Charlie Watts said he never listened to a Rolling Stone album.
That's funny. That's really funny. I don't believe that for a second. Yes, but yeah, it's a funny part of the legend, right?
Yeah.
You question the credulity of much that you hear when you talk about the Rolling Stones.
Yep. Yeah. All right, so we're gonna slide into the last song on the album, "Salt of the Earth."
Hard-working people, let's drink to the lonely occur. Raise your glass to the good and the evil. Let's drink to the salt of the earth. Say a prayer for the common good soldier. Spare a
heart. I adore this song so much. This may be my favorite Rolling Stones song. I absolutely love this. I get chills whenever I hear that, when the choir comes in and starts taking over the lyrics. I love the piano on it. The piano is just...
Those are the Honeys, right? The choir?
Yeah, yeah.
The Honeys?
They were a choir, but there are four from the choir.
The Watts Gospel Choir, I thought is where...
Yeah, but they have a group called the Honeys.
I have the exact opposite feeling about this song.
Really?
I think the first 30 seconds of the song are remarkable, and I think that the wonderfulness of that song goes out the window and is just overblown nonsense after that. I love Richard's vocals on this song because they're so fragile sounding and they work so well in the beginning, and then Jagger kicks in and does his swaggery jaggery thing, and then it just goes way over the top. It's not a bad song, but the promise of those first 30 seconds are lost, and it makes me sad to think about that.
When it goes to that double time, I like the sentiment of it. I like the way there's a part where Jagger and Richards are singing together, which is one of my favorite.
They sound pretty good together, but
they're one of my favorite singing tandems in the world.
I wouldn't go that far. Brothers, you got the Everly Brothers.
I know, but I just there's something so... Jagger's got a pretty clear voice, and you got Richard, who's just got, you know, sounds like he's smoked 9,000 cigarettes in a week, you know. I
wonder why.
But
what do you think the sentiment of the song is?
This is, well, I heard it was based on John Lennon. It was John Lennon's working class hero. They were kind of entering that.
Okay. I don't disagree with that. I've had a little obsession with the term salt of the earth.
Well, it's biblical, right?
It's biblical, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's so much disagreement about, are they talking about you're the flavor? Are they talking about you're the preservative?
Or what? No, go ahead. I think I know what you're going at. Go.
Well, I don't.
Oh. No, I mean what the other option is.
Well, there's one that's... I heard this one guy. I've only heard this from one person who said they used it to fertilize because some sands or some soils need more salt. I've never heard that anywhere else.
Well, it does the opposite. So maybe that's the meaning too.
To keep something from growing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's what I thought you were going with when I said and...
I agree with both of y'all. I think it's a good song, and I think they should have stayed closer to the production at the beginning, and
what about the choir?
That's fine.
Yeah,
but some of the it's sweet at the beginning, and
fragile.
Yeah, don't give that up.
Yeah, that's the way I was feeling.
That's how I feel. The whole song goes.
I don't think Jagger's voice can do sweet.
The feeling of when
he's a predator.
Well,
and I don't mean sexually. I mean,
he's an alpha male singer.
And if you remember when you're a little kid and you'd ask, "Mommy, is that a good dinosaur or a bad dinosaur?"
Yeah.
And good dinosaur, man, it eats plants.
Yeah.
Jagger, if Jagger were a dinosaur, he would never have eaten a plant in his life. This song is for a plant eater, and I didn't know I was going there with this whole thing.
Well, I just again, it's that Richards is so vulnerable,
yeah,
and it works so well for that. Again, I don't want to say it's a bad song. It's just that I'm not familiar with this. I'll be honest with you, I'd never listened to this song prior to this album, and when I first heard it, I was like, "Wow, this is something."
Here we go.
and it just disappointed me because there was so much promise in that first 30 seconds.
Well, I'm one of the first people in the world to disparage Keith Richards' vocals. When he sings like Silver and Gold off of later albums, it's just not one of my... I have a distaste for it. I love the way he sings in Happy.
I
like Southside when he sings Happy.
It's nice. It's a nice contrast to what Doug was talking about.
Yeah. What I like is Keith Richards' voice, not so much because of his voice, but because here's a break.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's a good contrast. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Emmylou Harris. Greatest background vocalist ever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's a great vocalist, but she is superb background vocalist. Mick Jagger cannot sing background. No. You remember when he tried to with Carly Simon?
You're so vain.
You know what it's similar?
Don't you?
You know what it's similar?
He can't stand the background.
It's similar to this, although I think this person is capable of a little more subtlety. It's like the comparison of Townsend and Daltrey,
yeah.
You know, Townsend, when he sings, can be much more sort of vulnerable than Daltrey can do it, but it's tough for him to do it.
It's really tough for him to do it.
Daltrey's a brass instrument,
mm-hmm.
and Townsend is a woodwind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they work great together.
They do.
But yeah. With Keith Richards, you don't really have an instrument.
But I like I like his voice. I know you said I've always liked songs he's sung on.
Our friend Beaver Nelson really likes
him. Yeah, I like Keith Richards' voice a lot.
Well, think about it reminds me of another Stone back when he's with the Faces.
Ronnie Wood?
When he's singing that.
Ooh la la.
Ooh la la.
Yeah.
It works. It's perfect.
It's perfect.
And his voice.
No.
If you walked into your studio and says, I want to record an album with you, you'd laugh. But it works so well on that song.
Right. No,
it's
I agree.
Same kind of deal.
I agree with that.
We've said this 1,000 times, but the human voice is there to communicate, and it doesn't have to be the prettiest oboe in the shop. It just has to communicate. And sometimes a bad voice can communicate better than a strong, pitch-perfect voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So this album hit number 3 in the UK charts and number 5 on the Billboard Top 200. It's a big critical success. Everybody's talking, this is a return to the Stones. The Stones are back. You know,
I've never really fully understood, because it seems to me that they are going off in a very different direction, and they still got that kind of blues bass maybe, but it's
very bluesy.
Yeah.
I compared to their Majesty's
Her Majesty's Secret. Their Majesty's.
I don't think it's a secret either.
Their Satanic Majesty's Request.
Which is none of us want called? To say Satan because we're such good
That compared to that, it's definitely a return back to the blues stuff, because there ain't a blues note on that album.
Yeah.
And and there ain't a note of Summer of Love on this one.
Well, not when so. This comes out, this is the most highly critically reviewed album they've ever had.
And this is
point, right?
Well, yeah, and I read that this is the most commercial. These four albums that we've been talking about are the most commercially successful period for the Stones. I guess they haven't ever.
I would think that.
I don't know. Didn't they just release another album that went straight to the top of the charts? And
but what are the charts now? I don't
know. I don't know. But
no one buys records anymore.
Well, they for the longest time, they were one of those bands that just, they were routinely the top grossing touring act in the world for like year after year.
And there is a difference between sometimes album sellers and touring bands.
Yeah.
Because part of it is you want to say, oh, yeah, I sell the Stones.
So the album goes gold in the UK. I think you mentioned that. It goes platinum in the US. It's a big deal. They do release a non-album single after this, and we've mentioned it at least once or twice talking, and that's Jumpin' Jack Flash, which if anybody needs me to play it, I'm happy to, but I think we all... This, as Jam mentioned earlier, this is the last album that Brian Jones has any significant contribution to. His behavior just continues to get worse and worse and worse. And when they start recording their next album, Let It Bleed, he's just kind of, he shows up, but he's not really there.
Yeah.
He borrows the group's Jaguar and leaves it someplace and it gets towed. He crashes his motorcycle into a shop in May of 1969, and he's secretly taken to the hospital under an assumed name so nobody knows what it is. He's just not doing much. Jagger informs Jones at one point they have a photo shoot, and he says, if you don't show up to this, you're gone. And he shows up to it, and he looks much worse for wear, but he does show up to it. They decide they're going to tour North America and after Let It Bleed, and they realize because of Jones's drug issues, I think he was actually convicted.
Yeah, I don't think he could have even if he wanted
to. He wasn't able to go.
Yeah.
So that June, he's visited by Mick, Keith, and Charlie, and they say, you know, sorry, you're done. You're out of the band, and they kick him out of the band. I think at the time they played it off like it was mutual, but it was anything but mutual. Sadly, a month after that, he's found dead in a swimming pool at the age of 27. Yeah.
Death by misadventure is what the...
Well, there's... I don't want to get into the whole conspiracy stuff. There's stories that somebody murdered him, all this other stuff. The sad thing is the guy died at 27 years old.
Yeah.
And he, you know, somebody who had a lot of promise that we talked about just kind of, you know, ends up...
Another 27-year-old.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I read doing some, doing research for this, he was a smart kid, but he would always just... hated authority. He was just, but he would do really, he would hardly ever study for classes, but he would take the tests and ace the tests. And, but he was also asthmatic, and it was a problem that kind of he had his whole life. And I think one thing that I read was that he always felt a little self-conscious about that. So a lot of what his distasteful behavior was just him kind of, he didn't want to be looked at as a wimp. And he was trying really hard to kind of puff out his chest a lot.
I do think...
And that's hard when you're asthmatic.
It is. Yeah. I do think
it's... Asthmatic.
I do think it's interesting that out of all the people in the band, all this whole bad boy image, he's really the one that personified it in a way that nobody else did. Yeah, so Keith Richards sort of adopts that persona later on. He's a heroin addict and other things go on. But
I wouldn't be surprised at all to say... Is this the best time? Okay. Has anyone contacted the newspaper? Yeah. Okay. Can we just have someone?
Well, there's, but you see him on the plane that they've got there. It's got naked girls just walking around on the plane.
That's rock and roll, right? But my point is that at this point, in
not
the
on
60s,
my plane.
In the 60s, he was the one that was kind of the true bad boy. I'm not saying that's a good thing.
Neither one of you read the biography
of what?
Keith Richards?
No.
It's supposed to be one of the best rock and roll biographies.
I would like to read it just because it's supposedly so disparaging of Mick.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine trashing someone you've worked with so long and you're about to work with
someone. He was mad that Jagger wanted to have his own album and write with somebody else. And he's going, you're going to, no, I'm your writing partner.
I can't imagine that either. Let him go do his own deal. Got married.
One question I have before we get to the ratings. I forgot to ask this early on. Does anybody know why they're called the Glimmer Twins?
No.
Do you know why they're called the Glimmer Twins? I mean, Jagger and Richards are called the Glimmer Twins, and I don't really know why.
I can beat you on that one.
What's that?
Not only do I not know why they're called that.
You didn't know they were?
I did not know they were called that.
Whenever they produce it, like all those reggae albums they produce, is produced by the Glimmer Twins.
I read someplace that they were on vacation together somewhere, and they were decked out in all this weird kind of finery, and they were on a boat, and somebody asked them what they do, and they were being hushed, being the older woman asked them what they do, and they were being kind of tight-lipped about it. And finally she goes, could you give us just a glimmer? And Jagger goes, we're the Glimmer Twins. I don't know if there's any truth to that, but
I like that someplace. One better than probably what's true. Yeah. We had a friend that took them on, they went to his dude ranch.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I went to a dude ranch, and he said that Mick, when he introduced himself, Mick Jagger went, hi, I'm Mick. And our friend went, yeah, I know who you are. And he said he was really nice guy. I guess it was the early 90s when he did this. But
there's no reason to think they wouldn't be pleasant or nice, you know? Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, upper middle class British boys.
Yeah.
So contrary to whatever their image is.
Yeah. You can always be polite.
All right, so this is the time in the podcast. We finally got into it, ladies and gentlemen, where we're going to give our opinion, our ratings of this album. We do two every episode. One is a critical rating where we take our personal interest out of it and just talk about the merits of the album based on that. And the other one is where we would be if we were going to, like, would we listen to it again, kind of our where our heart is. One is where our mind is, and one is where our heart is. So I'm going to go to you first, Doug, since you did not pick this album. Doug?
In fact, I did not pick this album. And I've never been happier that we give two ratings. Whoever came up with the two ratings.
I think that was you, Doug.
Is that me? Well, it was a genius move. Personal rating is a 3. I will listen to this album again, but not for a while. Critical rating, it's a 4.7. There's obviously very intelligent things happening here. Groundbreaking productions. Frequently, Jagger writes good lyrics. So I do think this is a very good album. Just not my cup of tea.
Okay, so I'm going to go next since I did not pick this either. I, like you, Doug, am very happy that we're giving this 2 ratings. I'm not going to go as high as you did on a critical rating, but I will say this was an exercise for me that was good because I realized that I needed to shake off all of my preconceived notions and listening to this critically and realize that this is a good band, that they're capable of writing some really compelling music. And as you said, some intelligent, smart lyrics that are compelling as well. I'm going to give it a 4.2 in terms of that. Looking in context, I guess if I were to put myself in the mindset of somebody who just listened to their psychedelic foray and then this came up, it would be kind of a refreshing return to what I was into in the first place. I really don't want to give a personal rating. There's still a lot of baggage for me on this band. I'll be clear. It's really Jagger. I'm not a fan of his. There are some things on this album he does really well, which also was a little surprising to me. But I can't imagine listening to this whole album again. I will pick songs off of it. I will pick the songs I talked about that I like.
No Expectations.
No Expectations, I think, is great. And
Factory Girl,
Prodigal Son, I kind of like. I've always been a fan of Street Fighting Man. If you're going to force my hand and make me give a personal rating, it'd be a 2.5. But again, that's me. I don't want people going, jerk. That's just me. This is not my cup of tea.
And that's not why you're a jerk.
There's other reasons. Anyway, so JM.
So as a critic, I just think these are a fantastic collection of songs. I think they are really well played. I'm going to give it a 5.0. It is to me, it is pretty much the pinnacle of rock and roll, especially at this time. And I, you know, when people say the Rolling Stones are the best rock and roll band in the world, this album to me really helps put them in that category. As a personal rating, like I said, this is not my favorite Rolling Stones album, but this period is my favorite Rolling Stones period. And I, like I said, this is the start of where I think the Rolling Stones were just had probably one of the greatest runs in popular music. Just, I don't think there is a bad song in any of these four albums. So I'm going to give it a 4.8 personally. I just think they did a really, really good job of just capturing the essence. Like each song to me just it is recorded and performed the way it's supposed to. And there's nothing overdone, and there's nothing in it that bores me at all, which is really difficult because it's hard for me to get through a whole album or a whole song and just not start, you know, getting bored with it. And I, like I said, for these four albums, I never am bored one bit. So it's a 4.8 personally. And the only reason it's not a 5 is because I know there's better stuff to come. All right. Well, thank you, dear listener, for listening to another episode of This is Vinyl Tap, the podcast that always goes to 11. Tell your friends about us, especially if they like long player format. We're available on most podcasting platforms. And please visit our Facebook group page or email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our website, tappingvinyl.com. You'll find ways to get to all our past episodes and find out about our recommendations. You'll also find videos and pictures and anecdotes of the artists that we've talked about on our episodes. Next week is a listener's pick, the 13th Floor Elevators, the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, thanks for listening, and here's raising a drink to the hardworking people.